ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our special guest is Susan Weinscheid, the speaker, author, behavioral scientist, and the CEO of the Team W Incorporated. And she's amazing, and I'm really glad that she made time for our recording. We are going to talk about designing for engagement today. This episode is brought to you by Envision. If you followed me for a while, you know that I'm an Envision fan. Their collaboration and design platform makes building digital products faster and easier. See for yourself with 3 months free for UI Breakfast listeners. Visit envisionapp.com/UIbreakfast to sign up. Hi, Susan.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for making the time.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
Fantastic. Let's start with a short questionnaire so that we can learn more about you before we dive into the main topic.
Okay.
So question number one is, what do you do for a living?
Oh, well, I speak and write and consult on applying behavioral science to life and to design.
That's a great short answer. Well, then you've got to elaborate a little bit more. How did you get there?
Oh, well, I've been doing this for a while, and I have a PhD in psychology, and I was a college professor for 1 year after I got my PhD, and then I went off and started a consulting company, and I was doing initially, you know, kind of regular usability type of consulting. This was quite a long time ago, and it was before the term UX or user experience or anything like that even existed. So I was doing basically, you know, how to design software so that it would be easier for people to use. And I did that for many years and taught and consulted and gave talks. And then, my background in psychology, and I always applied psychology, but luckily for me, maybe about 10 years ago or so, the whole field of, you know, the whole idea of bringing psychology into design, which is what I had always done, but a lot of people thought that was really strange for most of my career. And then luckily it became like a popular thing. And so now it's not so strange, and I've been able to even, you know, broaden the different kinds of psychology. And there's so much amazing new work that has gone on in the last 10 to 15 years in terms of studying behavioral economics, and also what's going on with our unconscious mental processing. We now have tools to really study that. And so it's enabled me to broaden what I'm doing, you know, even bigger in terms of behavioral science and design. So that's been a lot of fun in the last, you know, 5 to 7 years.
How did you arrive to that, you know, direction and use case for psychology? Because we usually think of psychology as something that relates to human beings, and now you're onto designing products all of a sudden.
Well, you know, when I was in graduate school, and I'm not going to tell you what year that was. Let's just say it was a long time ago. And they had a requirement I was at Pennsylvania State University, and they had a requirement that you had to take a foreign language course as part of graduate school. But they had a really weird twist to it, because you could opt, instead of a foreign language, you could opt for a computer language. I have no idea why they did that.
Whoa.
So I actually did that because I had never done any programming. And so I will tell you, this was so long ago that very few people even had direct interaction with computers. I know you're going to have find that hard to believe, but that was true. And so I started studying, you know, how to make computers do things, and was instantly struck by the fact that it wasn't designed at all, especially back then, to be usable by, you know, normal everyday people. You were, you know, if you were a computer scientist, if you'd been trained, if you were an engineer, then maybe you could figure out how to use a computer. But for the rest of us, it was going to be pretty impossible. And that I just became fascinated with what happens, you know, when ordinary people have to use these things. So my interest in the intersection between technology and people has been gone on for a really, really long time. It's just something I was always fascinated with. And to me, it makes perfect sense. I mean, we're talking about, you know, basically technology is a tool. It's the way we use the tool has changed so much over the last couple of decades. But it's still a tool, you know. I mean, even when if we're talking about virtual reality or sociable robots or, you know, our smartphones, whatever the technology is, driverless cars, you're talking about people interacting with a machine. And I'm just fascinated by the how well does that work?
Great story. What does your typical day look like?
Oh, boy, do I have a typical day. Well, it's really different if I'm on the road giving talks and workshops versus if I'm at home in my home office and studio. I like today, a typical day today, because I'm not on the road today. I am back home in Wisconsin. What we're doing right now is pretty typical. So I'm in my Iowa studio. My office is now in my house. I used to have an office building, but I've moved everything back into the house. And so I have a studio. I have a video and audio studio in my home, in my office, because I do a lot of podcasts. We have our own podcast we do called Human Tech. And so we record that. And then I do a lot of online video training courses. And so I'm sitting here right now in a setup. I'm looking at I have my lights on because we were on video before we started the podcast. I have my camera. So I will spend time recording on camera, doing a podcast. I do a lot of video editing. Right now I'm a science advisor to a television show. So I will spend a lot of time today, for instance, on the phone, talking with various experts that have to do with the TV show. I spend a lot of time on Skype and phone. I read a lot of so a typical day might, I probably am reading some research papers and preparing for, you know, talks and workshops. I have some workshops coming up, so I'll spend some time today working on those talks. So that's a pretty typical day if I'm at home.
Mm-hmm. So the consulting work you do is exactly consulting. You talk with people, give them recommendations about their products or whatever they need your advice on.
Yeah, I mean, the consulting varies a lot. You know, sometimes I'll do what you might think of as kind of typical evaluations of a product or service to see what the user experience issues might be. You know, with the consulting I'm doing right now, like I said, I'm a research science advisor for a TV show. So that involves a lot of interviews and meetings and actually looking up kind of the latest research on various topics. I don't do anymore a lot of really detailed design and prototypes and wireframing. I used, you know, for many years, I did that a lot. These days, if I have that work, I usually am working with you know, one of our colleagues or contractors and having them do the detailed design part. So I'm usually doing the more high-level advice part.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about the Team W? You have an enormous library of content. Who is the Team W? How do you publish all that? And tell us a little bit more.
Well, you know, the Team W, we've got a number of advisors and colleagues that are not employees that we are working with. And in fact, I'm in conversation with someone right now about working with them to do some new courses for us. But in terms of the company itself, it's really, really small, which is on purpose.
Definitely.
And it's me and it's another wonderful person who happens to share my last name because it's my son. His name is Guthrie Weinchenk, and he's my COO. And Guthrie is a behavioral economist. He has a degree in economics, and he also has a law degree. And so he does courses with me, and he does similar work, but has a little bit different emphasis because of the economics degree. But together, we we do a lot of the work ourselves. We do a lot of we pretty much do the recording, the video recording ourselves. Guthrie does a lot of the video editing, and I do some of it. And we do have a lot of content, and we have even more content planned. My list of courses that we're going to be working on, either I'm going to be recording or Guthrie is, or as I said, we're working with some colleagues, is quite long. But I love teaching, so I love working on the online video courses. It's a little strange sitting in Wisconsin sometimes in the middle of winter with snow falling, and I'm sitting here talking into a camera for hours. It's a little bit of a surreal experience, but I really do love it. And we get wonderful feedback from people. I'm always hearing from people who are taking our courses or going through our certificates. So I feel when I'm talking into the camera that I'm talking to real people.
Yeah, I know how it feels exactly.
Exactly. Yes, right.
Right. It's pretty awesome how internet empowers our ability to interact with people. Really amazing. When you publish new courses, I'm just super curious, how did you do you define, the topic and the scope for them?
Well, we do. I think about it a lot, and I hear from people. Sometimes we do surveys. In fact, we're due to do another one to find out, what is it that people want to learn about. I teach a course every semester at the University of Wisconsin, and so I actually use that opportunity to try out new ideas, new topics, with my students there and develop curriculum there. And then I will often turn that into a course. So I think for me, it's, listening to what it is that people seem to want to learn about and or need to know, and what they feel like they want to get mastery over. I really like the idea of not having not just one course, but an entire curriculum. I think if people can get a degree in some of these programs, can get a master's degree or a bachelor's, I think that's wonderful. But I just know how we can't always do that. And yet we want more than just, one workshop. So I like really taking a topic like user experience or brain and behavioral science and really, going into it very deeply. And so in terms of how we decide on, what the curriculum of a particular topic is going to be, we spend a lot of time just gathering our thoughts on if people have said to us, I wish there was a way I could learn this topic online. And then we'll just kind of brainstorm, all the different, if you were going to earn a certificate in brain and behavioral science, what would you need to know? I can tell you, I spend an enormous amount of time doing affinity diagrams and post-it notes all over my desk to figure out, you know, which topic goes with what, you know, how are we going to organize it. It's particularly interesting, I think, when you're doing the online video courses, because we have a particular set way we like to do them. We like to have 6 lessons in each course, and we like to have 6 courses in each of the certificate curriculum. So, you know, that gives it some structure to us. But it's really hard sometimes. Sometimes I have to decide, like, what to leave out, you know, and because it's just too much. I was recording, Jane, a new version of our user testing course just like 2 weeks ago. And, you know, I had my whole outline, and I started recording based on my outline and my notes. And before I knew it, I had like twice as much material as I was supposed to have. It was like, oh no, now what are you going to do? So we never have a problem coming up with material. We probably have the opposite problem. We come up with too much.
Yeah. What do you enjoy the most and the least about your work?
I definitely enjoy the teaching the most, and figuring out, you know, how to not just explain a topic, but also come up with like quizzes and tests and exercises so that people can really learn about it and learn how to apply it. And that's very challenging, I think, when you're doing it online. And we also do, you know, in-person workshops. So teaching and speaking for me are probably the most fun, and figuring out, you know, what I want to teach and speak about. The thing I enjoy the least? Well, you know, I've been able to give the things I enjoy the least to my son to do. So he does all, you know, he has a law degree, so he does all my contract negotiations and paperwork and taxes and all of that. So I'm able to focus a lot on what I like. But if I had to say what I enjoy the least, you know, you never can get away from having to keep all your ideas organized. And I still don't think, I mean, I've tried so many online tools, you know, for keeping your, you know, for being able to brainstorm online and collaborate online and keep your ideas organized. And I don't know if it's me or the tools, but I wish they were better. That's probably the part I enjoy the least, because I feel like I'm, you know, I have a lot of ideas and I want to get them down, and I feel like the tools hold me back.
What is your current favorite, or what have you tried already? I'm very curious.
Oh my goodness. I've probably tried, you know, I mean, name a tool for organizing ideas, and I've probably tried it, or for collaborating online. Right now, the tools we're using the most for that is Asana. I don't know if you know Asana.
Yeah, a project management tool. Sure.
Yeah, and that's working pretty well. Out of all the ones that I've tried, it's probably working the best. I still, you know, it's still not perfect. And then we use mainly, I mean, I'm on Skype every day, and sometimes for hours a day if I'm in my home office. So that's our, you know, our primary collaboration tool, plus all the, you know, Google Drive, you know, documents. But it's still not, it's not seamless enough.
Sorry to hear. There is definitely place for some great products there, I guess.
Yes, someone work on it, please.
What is your next big thing?
My next big thing. Well, I'm pretty excited about this, you know, the advising I'm doing on the TV show. I kind of always wanted to do that. And then I think, Jane, that's a great question. My next big thing is probably, I'm thinking about a series of smaller books that we would self-publish electronically and in print. You know, I've written a lot of books, and I haven't done a major book writing since 2015, which isn't that long ago. But I have some ideas for some books. So, but I don't know that I want to go the, you know, all my books have been published. Like my early books were published by Wiley, and then I had 5 books over the last 8 years or so, 9 years, published with Pearson. And I'm thinking for the next round, we may do them ourselves. So that would be a big undertaking to, first of all, publish them ourselves, and then secondly, to write some more books. So that might be my next big thing.
Sounds great. You seem to have absolutely full predisposition for, you know, you've already have the audience, you have all the fame from traditional publishing route. So it's time to make some big money with self-publishing.
Yeah. On that one? All right.
Absolutely. Great idea. Happy to hear that you're on it. So the main topic of our conversation today is design for engagement. And yeah. I stole the idea from one of your quick guides, actually. I think the topic itself is pretty well-rounded, and we all our listeners are somehow engaged with software, with SaaS, and we want to know how to design for engagement, how to make people use it. Because I'm a founder myself, I find that the most interesting and challenging task is not getting people in the door, but making them stay and use the app.
Yes.
And here you go with your science. Hopefully, we're going to hear some new insights today. If you were to recite the essence of your theory, could you recap that in a few sentences to start with?
Well, you know, if you're going to design a product so that it's engaging, and so not just that it's easy to use, which is critical and which is definitely part of engagement, but that people want to use it, are motivated to use it. That means you have to look at, you know, what is the science of human motivation? So what makes people do something? What makes them initially do it, and what makes them come back and do it again? And so, you know, what is that? Well, there's, I think there are a couple of parts. One is, I talk about human biology, the things about our eyes, the things about our brains, the things about our hearing, the chemicals that are in our bodies, dopamine, oxytocin. And so, you know, in my mind, you have to understand some of that if you're going to understand what grabs people's attention and what makes them feel motivated. So there's the biology part, and then there's the motivation part. There's 7 drivers to human motivation that I've written about. And so you've got to understand in general what motivates people to take action. And then, of course, you always want to understand your particular audience and decide which of those 7 drivers, given the audience and given the product, which of those 7 drivers are the best ones to use. So once you understand the biology and once you understand the motivation, there's 2 other things I would say. One is you've got to make sure that you're talking to all 3. I talk about the 3 brains, you know, the new brain, the conscious brain, and then the emotional brain, and then the old brain, sometimes called the reptilian brain. And we make a mistake in design. Sometimes we spend a lot of time focusing our design aspects on the conscious brain. So we want to make sure that things are easy to understand and people know what the label is and they know where to find something. And that's all very important, but that's just one little piece. So then, you know, the question is, how do you engage the unconscious? We know that 90% of mental processing occurs unconsciously. And so how do you, you know, how do you speak to that part of the person? And so, and then the last thing that you need to do is make sure that you are designing for your particular audience and applying everything I just talked about, mm-hmm. you know, for your particular audience and your particular product. Because, you know, there are, for example, you know, if my goal is, you know, it's an app and I want people to use it every day and I want them to use it 10 times a day, you know, okay. That means I'm talking about how to build in a habit into product use. The way that you build habit is different than, for instance, if this is a product that, you know, I want people to, I know they're only going to use it once a month, but I want to make sure that when it's time to do, you know, whatever it is, their financial high-level viewpoint, you know, or whatever they're doing once a month, I want to make sure they use my product, right? Well, that's not necessarily habitual because it's not every day. And so, you know, how can I make sure that they're wanting to do that? Or how can I make sure they want to use my program to learn a language, you know, rather than someone else's? So, you know, it depends on the product and it depends on the person.
All right. Sounds like a great curriculum. Can you give us a brief overview of the biology? Because from what I understand about modern state of UX, we have three sources of proving our point. One is behavioral science and biology. The other is data and research. And the last one is probably something that we call common sense or general practice or something like that. And the one I know least of is biology. We would love to have some insight.
Okay, yeah, there's so many things, but I'll just, you know, throw some out there.
Yes.
So, for instance, we know about, let's talk about vision. We know that when you see something, there are different parts of your visual cortex that are stimulated. And we talk about kind of pre-vision or early vision. And so the things that grab our attention visually very early on, and I'm talking about, you know, in milliseconds, right, are if something is a different color, a different size, or a different orientation, like instead of up and down, it's tilted a little bit, or if it moves, especially if it grows or, you know, starts small and grows big, like in animation. And our eyes and our brain are built in just the way we've evolved, that those are the things that grab our attention. However, if you use them all together, then it doesn't grab our attention anymore. So if you want to get someone's visual attention, what you want to use is have something be a different color or a different size or a different orientation, or to zoom in, but you only want to do one of those things at the moment, and that will grab someone's visual attention. So that's just a really simple, you know, way that you can combine this idea of design for engagement with what we know about how the human, you know, visual system works. We also know, another thing I would say is we know that there are basically two kinds of vision. One is central vision and one is peripheral vision. And central vision is the part, you know, when you're looking straight ahead at something, and it's a very small area that you can see really, really clearly. And everything else in your vision is called peripheral vision. And you know, it's actually what we now know is that our peripheral vision, even if you have, you know, if you say, oh, I have perfect vision, I have 20/20 vision, that's your central vision. Everybody's peripheral vision is very blurry. And so you might say, well, see, I mean, when you do eye tracking research in usability studies, that eye tracking is on central vision, and that's the only part that's important. But that's not true. We actually know that our peripheral vision is so important to us that even though it's blurry, that we process images of danger faster in peripheral vision. We process movement in peripheral vision. And actually, we now know that our peripheral vision decides where our central vision should look next. So a lot of the information we're taking in peripheral vision is we are processing unconsciously. We're not even aware that we've necessarily seen something, but it has definitely affected how we feel. It affects whether we think we're in the right place, and it affects what we look at next. So I think designers sometimes focus too much on what's in central vision. You know, we used to call it prime real estate on the screen. And we really need to think about what's in peripheral vision as well, because that may be more important even than what's in central vision.
How does that translate to actual parts of the user interface? The central part would be the workspace that we're designing currently, and the peripheral part would be maybe navigation and sidebars or something like that?
That's correct. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, you know, we have this tendency to think, well, we'll put the most important thing in the middle and then, you know, we won't worry about what's in the periphery. But you should worry about what's in the periphery, because people are seeing it and they're using it to decide if they're in the right place and what they want to do next. So you want it, you know, a lot of times if you look at some modern day especially websites, you know, the peripheral vision is blank because, you know, we're concerned about resizing and resolution and, you know, all of that. And so we don't put anything. It was just white space. So that means that the page is going to seem not important. It's going to seem boring. The peripheral vision isn't going to know what to look at next. So, yeah, you want to think really carefully about, you know, what should we put in peripheral vision? Should there be an image that goes along with where the person is so that they can decide very quickly, unconsciously, that they are indeed in the right place? You know, the navigation should definitely be in peripheral vision so that I know unconsciously that it's there and that if I want to go somewhere else, I know where to look for that. So just think about, you know, spend some time thinking about what should be and what you want in the peripheral vision instead of just assuming that the only important place is central vision. So that's, and I guess I would throw out one other example in terms of, you know, vision would be color. You know, we know, for example, that the color blue is a color that we don't perceive very well. Humans don't perceive the color blue very well. And if you look at charts of how much of our visual spectrum is devoted to different colors, you know, color is really just wavelength. And so if you look at, you know, how the different wavelengths that our eyes see, for some reason, I'm not sure why, it's some evolutionary thing, I'm not sure why this happened, but we don't see blue very well. And it's so interesting to me that, for instance, blue was, I don't know that it is as much anymore, but for years it was the standard hypertext link color. And we know that people actually don't see it very well. And as you get older, you see it less and less. So, you know, you really can't rely on people being able to really notice the color blue.
Yes, absolutely. Great example with the blue color. I heard that the most, well, of course, attention-grabbing color for adults is red and green. But I, as a designer, I see people overusing that quite a bit. What's your take on that?
Well, you know, green is in a similar wavelength spectrum to blue, right? It's not that far mm-hmm. from blue. So, I mean, you can definitely see green much better than blue. I think that, and if you have, you know, you got to remember that 9% of men are colorblind, and the most common form of colorblindness is red-green colorblindness, right, where they have a hard time distinguishing between red and green, so you want to be careful about that. I think that you know, one reason I think that red and green red in some cultures, not all cultures, but for instance, in the United States, red you know, means stop and danger, right? And that would grab our attention. In other cultures, red might mean lucky, good, you know, it's a good color. That might grab some attention. I think a lot of times with the red and green, it really is just that those colors are different from everything else on the page. And so, you know, we tend, most designers for most cultures aren't going to create a screen that is full of red and green, you know, where
Hopefully.
The background is red,
yeah, right?
Or the background is green. And so that me, so the, I think one reason that red and green work well for, you know, action CTAs for action buttons is because not that much on the screen is red or green. So that, so those colors are, you know, if I use red or I use green, that pops out. I mean, that's back to what we were talking about the V1 vision area.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I think it's almost more an artifact of the, it's not necessarily the color itself. I mean, if everything on the screen were green, you know, then a white button might be particularly good. So I think it's really just, the idea is that you want something that is unusual to, it's really just capturing that V1 visual attention area.
Mm-hmm. I would like to go back a little bit to the visual composition and peripheral vision, because that really strikes my chord. There is a whole philosophy of, you know, conversions and how they're driven in modern web design and in web apps. So we observe a ton of sites which have removed all the material for peripheral vision entirely. And there are even people who take away the navigation from the top just to place it in the footer and not visible at all times.
Yeah.
And you're saying that it's not the best pattern because the user is deprived of that material for their peripheral vision.
Yeah, I mean, you know, think again, the peripheral vision is deciding what you should do next. And,
right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, well, I mean, and definitely if you want people to push a button, if the only thing on the screen is the button,
right,
then chances are they're going to push it. But,
right.
That, you know, that's getting a little, right? Usually we have more than just one button on the screen. But I think that's, you know, that speaks also to the question of, you know, what is the context? And one of the things that when I'm teaching, like I have a workshop called Design for Engagement. And when I teach that workshop, you know, what I teach people is at any given moment, right? Because really, this idea of being engaging, it's the moment. It's this micro moment. So at any given moment, what is the thing that the user wants to do, and what is the thing that you want them to do, which might not be the same thing, by the way, which is interesting, right?
Exactly.
And then, you know, given that they want to do X and you want them to do Y, you know, how should you design that particular form or page or moment in order for you know, for them to take the action you want them to take, if that's what you want to do. And so when you look at it that way, right, then you can get very, very specific about, you know, what should be on the page. So for instance, if I said, well, you know, what I want, you know, they're there to look up their checking book balance, right? But what I want them to do is I want them to notice that we have this really special rate on car loans this, you know, right now, and that if they're interested in, you know, we happen to know because we have our you know, ways of getting data about our customers, and we know that you know, they're interested in buying a car, and so we think that they might be interested in a car loan, and we're offering the special rate on a car loan. So they're there to check their bank balance, but we want them to really notice about the car loan, right? And that's our goal, and that's the context. So given that, you know, we can put their bank balance right in the central part of the screen so they can see it, so that can be useful to them. But perhaps in the periphery, which they will notice, maybe we put Now remember, peripheral vision is not very clear. It's blurry. So we put, you know, a very large picture, a very simple picture of an exciting new car. And, you know, shiny and red or in some color that is not what everything else on the screen is. And then we put in very big letters, because very big font, because it's peripheral vision and it's not very clear unless it's big. You know, we put a special, you know, we have a special auto loan rate of 3% through the end of the month. And so that, you know, the idea is that because that's in peripheral vision and it's large and, you know, it's colorful, after they check their bank balance, they're going to tend to look over at that image. And therefore, we might be able to grab their attention and, you know, with a nice big button worded in a way that speaks to their self story, because we know about human motivation.
Right.
And then they'll be more likely to click that button.
You mentioned the big problem. Being a founder, I still don't understand which goal is more important for me. Like, it's obvious that they want to do their, you know, utility function. They want to check their balance. But as a founder, do I want them to comfortably check the balance and become happy with the product? Or do I want to implement my, you know, conversion goals and upsell goals and others that make me make money? Which of them is more important? Which of them should be more important for me as a founder?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have the answer to that. I mean, that's isn't that the question? You know, the question. I mean, you have to decide. And the good news is that a lot of the time, not always, but a lot of the time, these two things can work together. Okay, there's no reason why by putting an offer and trying to interest you in a new offer, putting that on the screen means that you can't see your bank balance very well. I mean, you know, I mean, it could. I mean, we've all had the experience, especially if you're designing a page in which there are many stakeholders that own a part of that page, right? That's what can really drive a designer crazy, because you've got, you know, the main purpose of the page is supposed to be that they check their bank balance, but now you've got like not just one stakeholder that wants the conversion to the auto loan, but five, you know, because these people over here want to get them interested in the home mortgage loan, and the right. I mean, these people over here want them to sign up for the new credit card, and the right. So then you end. That's typically the situation where you end up with these pages that, you know, are so crowded or confusing that the person can't even just look up their bank balance. So you have to watch out for that. And certainly, you know, you have to, I would guard against anything like, well, before, I mean, I don't think anyone would do this, but I've seen things not too far from this where, you know, you can't see your bank balance, right, until you go through the first screen with all the offers. I mean, we wouldn't want to do that. And yet, we often see similar situations to that where, you know, hey, I'm just trying to get this information and now you're, you know, I have to go through three steps just to get to what supposedly I was going to be able to get to if I, you know, clicked on the link. So there are times when usability and designing for engagement don't fit together, and they're fighting each other. And to me, that's, you know, usually a problem, and it means that, you know, we have to talk about it and straighten it out. And the other thing you really have to guard against as well, doesn't come up as frequently, are ethical issues, you know, where we're going to use a design to make it so confusing that you don't realize you just signed up for a subscription service.
Oh, that's not nice. That's blackmailing.
No, and in fact, in some cases, in some countries, it's actually illegal. You know, there are things that you, in the United States, I've done some consulting work with the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission. I'm sometimes an expert witness for them when they're suing a company for being deceptive. And so there are things that are unwise, which are, you know, making the usability so hard that I can't do it just because you want me to click on a different button. There are things that are unethical, right, where it's really not right to do that. And then there's things that are illegal. You know, that's kind of your stages.
Right.
Your stages to hell, you know. So I think you have to, I think you definitely have to guard against that. And I think as we get, as our technologies get, I mean, we've been talking about, you know, online banking, but as we get even further, you know, into virtual reality or augmented reality or sociable robots, you know, I think the ethical questions become even larger.
Absolutely. Could you walk us through the 7 drivers of human motivation briefly as a list?
Mm-hmm. Sure. So we have, in no particular order here, I'm just going to give them off the top of my head. So we have something I call the power of stories, and that especially the power of self stories, the stories we tell ourselves about who we are really drive our behavior. We have the desire for mastery. We all want to learn and grow new skills, and that drives our behavior. We have rewards and punishments, which are sometimes called carrots and sticks.
Mm-hmm.
We have habits, automatic, unconscious reactions. And let's see, that's 1, 2, 3, 4. So let me see if I can remember what the other 3 are. I'm sure I can. If I can't, I'm in a lot of trouble. We have instincts. These are unconscious things that we do that are related to our survival coming from the old brain. We have something I call tricks of the mind, and that's a whole little collection of strange things our brains do having to do with cognitive biases or Daniel Kahneman's wonderful work on System 1 and System 2 thinking. And let's see, what did I leave out? Did I forget anything? I said, sorry for mastery, habits, tricks of the mind, power of stories. Oh, and the last one, the need to belong. Our biologically and psychologically driven desire to be part of a group.
So, well, I can totally say how that can relate to copywriting, for example, or designing ads to be displayed on that peripheral side of the page. But when we talk about product design, these should be translated into features which drive human behavior and the desire to use the product because of that. For example, the mastery could be converted into a certain system of ratings or something, evaluations inside the app or something like that.
I think it's all of these can be used in a variety of ways. So, for instance, mastery could be just in terms of how you describe the product. It certainly could be, you know, levels inside of the app, right? How, you know, you're at the beginning level, you're at the intermediate level, you've now reached, you know, the master level, that kind of thing. But it can also be, you know, how you talk about it. So I'll give you an example. With our online video courses, we initially had, we were selling each course individually. So we had a course on, you know, user testing and a course on user research and a course on designing for engagement. And you know, you could sign up for any of those courses. And then when I was thinking about the desire for mastery, I realized, well, if we put all the courses together and instead of just taking a course, you actually could take the whole curriculum and then you would master the body of knowledge around user experience. And I realized that was going to be much more motivating. And we did that. And we actually ended up selling much more courses, many more courses, because people would buy the bundle. And in fact, I would have to say that 90% of the time when someone buys our online video training, they buy the entire curriculum. They don't just buy one course. And, you know, that's because of this idea that we really want to feel like we're mastering a body of knowledge. With habits, you know, we know that visual cues and auditory cues can trigger the release of dopamine and make us take action. And so if you want people, if you want using your app or your product to become a habit, a daily or an hourly habit, you know, you want to make sure you're using visual cues, auditory cues, and also randomness actually fuels habit. So, you know, there's all, I think you get back into the questions about ethics as soon as you start talking about that or any of these really. But yeah, I think it's, you know, it can have to do with a feature. It can have to do with just the design of a particular screen or page or flow of interaction.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But if we're talking about ethics, if the person signed up for a web app to achieve specific result, if we're acting, if we're encouraging them or even not tricking them, but yeah, building a habit for them to use it regularly, it's not, it's totally ethical. We are actually acting in their best behalf.
I think so. Although I want, you know, I think these things can be so powerful and we don't realize that we're using them when we design. And so I think there are sometimes unintended consequences. So, I mean, just think about your smartphone. I assume you have a smartphone.
Yes, I do.
What do you have?
I had a birthday yesterday and I got the brand new iPhone 7 in black.
Oh, well, happy Not birthday.
Thank you. I was 30.
Well, you know, when the iPhone was developed, and I don't know, or any of the smartphones, well, I guess the iPhone was the first smartphone. You know, I don't know. It's possible that, you know, Apple wanted it to be an addictive product or understood how addictive it would be. But I'm guessing they really didn't quite realize that because of the capability and the way it worked and because of the visual cues and the auditory cues and the unpredictability of when you're going to get a message and the, you know, the social networking aspect of it, I don't know that they realized that we would get to the point where some of us have a very, very difficult time if for any reason we can't have our smartphones with us all the time and on all the time. And, you know, that so many people, when they wake up in the morning, the first thing they reach for is their smartphone. And, you know, the just how addictive, and I don't mean that in a drug and physiological way, but in a habit way, you know, how important that product would become to us. And the fact that it comes to, there's some research now that show that it actually represents our entire social network. It's as though we're never alone anymore. Wherever we are, all of our friends and family are in the room with us. And the psychological difference that makes, which can be positive or not. And so I think sometimes these things have unintended consequences that, you know, we may not realize.
Yeah, when I was in high school, I made a report, or rather it was an emotional speech about the dangers of online communication, how, you know, engaged you can become in that world. And now here I go sitting in Russia and everything I have related to my work is entirely online. That's somewhat scary. And all my friends are online. That's really, really a good and a bad thing at the same time.
That's right. We don't always know what the consequences are of what we're doing.
Exactly. So we have to wrap this episode up because the time is running out, but we could probably spend a lot more time chatting about
this. We probably could.
Yeah. If you were to give a single piece of advice to people who are trying to make their web application engaging, what would be one thing they should do and one thing they should avoid?
I think the one thing they should do is to go through that little series of questions that we talked about before. You know, ask yourself, either for the application in general or for a particular point, a particular moment in the use of the application, what is it that your user wants to do at this point, and what do you want them to do? And then based on the answers to that, make a design decision for that micro moment. I think that's really, to focus at that level can be really helpful. And then the thing I would say to not do is don't do too much. So less is more. Resist the urge to put one more thing on the page or one more design element or one more feature or one more option. People like to have a lot of options and choices, but the research shows very clearly that if you give them too many options, they just won't do anything. So I would say use less.
This is a beautiful piece of advice. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
So, Susan, where can people find you online?
Our website is theteamw, so T-H-E, and then the word team, T-E-A-M, and then W.com. And, that has, you can get to everything from there. I'm on Twitter at thebrainlady.
Oh, beautiful. And if you'd like to give our listeners a discount for one of your products, so if they want to continue talking to you and learning from you.
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. I think we can offer, we'll set up a discount for our any of our online video courses.
Mm-hmm. That sounds great. So the discount code is going to be UI Breakfast, and I'll include the link in the show notes. So if anyone is interested, you can follow up there.
That's great. And, I do want to mention that some of our, we have a couple of courses like our UX Fundamentals course and our Brain and Behavioral Science Fundamentals course. Those are free anyway. So even if any of your listeners don't necessarily want to buy anything, but they just want to get something, they can get, we actually have a couple of free courses they can take.
Sounds fantastic. Susan, thank you so much for joining us today, for sharing your wisdom, just a tiny bit of wisdom. I know it was probably even offensive to ask a PhD to share things about biology in 2 minutes. I'm just literally telling red here. Yes, but thank you.
It's just difficult for us to not talk for hours.
Yes, thank you so much, and have a beautiful day.
Thank you, Jane. Bye bye.